Quorum, but since this meeting is an informational meeting, I really want to give the departments the benefit of the doubt in terms of their time and respect that, and hear from you with those of us that are present at the moment. So the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services is now alive and well. And in color. So what I want to do is, Dr. Goldberg, you want to just have some words and bring your people up? Well, what is your pleasure?
I think you heard from me yesterday, so
okay.
We could just go forward with...
With Bob Nickel.
How's that?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Bob.
Madam Chair, if I may, that's all right.
Okay.
Mr. Nickel will begin on the tab that's entitled Addictions and Mental Health Division in the notebooks in front of you.
But John, forgive me. Are there some opening remarks that you'd like to give us today? I'm not being very much.
Thank you so much.
So rushed.
No opening remarks.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sheila taught me better than that. Bob.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm Bruce's assistant director, and my area of responsibility is addictions and mental health. And since this is the first time for us to speak to the Ways and Means Subcommittee, we are now a division again, as are the other former offices, so we're back to where we were a few years ago. The idea is not to further divide the department, but to be consistent with other state agencies and state departments. So I'm pleased to be able to begin the discussion about what we do, and your handout starts with the division overview, and we provide our part of the department's mission by pointing out that we're about preventing and reducing the negative effects of alcohol, other drugs, gambling addiction, mental health disorders, and also promoting recovery through culturally competent trauma-informed care. Madam Chair, Representative Boone and I talked just a little bit before about the issues that are connected with people who have had traumatic experiences. I'm pleased to say the department recently adopted a behavioral trauma policy, which followed upon my division's adopting that about a year ago. So that's an issue that we may want to talk further about as we go further. But I think it's really important to recognize that many of the people that we serve either have the origin of their problem in a traumatic event of some kind, or after they become mentally ill or addicted, they're much more likely to be exposed to those kind of traumas. So I want to make sure that we start off with a clear statement about that. So our key in the public sector, of course, is serve people who are indigent or Medicaid eligible with the state and federal funds that we're responsible for. During 2005-06, that calendar year, we served in alcohol and drug treatment. We served 56,000 adults and 7,000 adolescents in a variety of services. I pointed out earlier in testimony to Representative Tomei's committee this morning that if you look at the incidence of alcohol and drug problems in our state, we estimate that we have about 450,000 people who have alcohol and drug problems. So you can see that while we serve a large number of people, it's probably on the order of about 12% of the people who are actually in need. Now, some people can probably get some of their services through AA and NA. We recognize that, support that. Other people may have insurance that will cover that, and certainly the parity bill that passed last session is going to help increase access to alcohol and drug services. But the public sector, because of cuts and simply because we've never really been terribly well-funded, really can only get at a portion of the people who have addictions issues. We have a nationally, if not internationally, known gambling addiction system, both treatment and prevention. We have one of the first residential programs in the country for gambling addiction, which just opened about 6-8 months ago. And with the lottery funds, which is a 1% set-aside, we served over 2,000 people in our gambling addiction program during 2005-2006. Alcohol and drug prevention is another key area. It's another area that we've lost funding over the last 10 years in. The governor's recommended budget, of course, adds some more back, and I think that's very critical in view of the fact that eighth grade girls now report to us that a third of them are already using alcohol. Another portion of kids that age are using other drugs. We've seen an increase in that. Now, eighth grade girls now are drinking more than eighth grade boys. These are sobering things for us to think about. The prevention area is a critical area. I think one of the things that we need to do a better job of in alcohol and drug prevention is using evidence-based practices. There are prevention efforts that sometimes probably to all of us have felt like a bit of a black hole. And we need to make sure that the money that we invest in alcohol and drug prevention goes towards those programs that either are very promising, even if there's not research yet, or to those kinds of programs that have research base. And there's quite a bit of that out there. We, again, we'll talk more about that. In community mental health, we serve primarily indigent adults who have serious mental illnesses. The first set of priorities, except in the Oregon Health Plan, and we'll talk about that in a minute, are for those adults who are at most risk of hospitalization, either voluntarily hospitalized but very close to being dangerous to themselves or others, or through the civil or criminal commitment processes. That's kind of the entry point for many people. We served 71,820 adults in fiscal year 2005-2006. And again, our estimate, which we testified earlier about in the other committee, is that there are about 160,000-170,000 people in the state who have major mental illnesses, about 5-6% of the population. So in the mental health area, we're serving probably 40-45% of the people we estimate who are at need. That still leaves a significant gap among people who have disorders like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and major depressions. Children, we've served 37,000 plus kids in 2005-2006. Our estimate there is that about 12-15% of kids need some sort of mental health treatment, and we're serving probably about 10% of the need there. So, I'm sorry, about 40% of the need there. So again, with kids, that's a pretty serious underfunding problem, in that every kid who has an untreated severe emotional disorder is going to have trouble in school and family relationships and friends, and that doesn't bode well for their future. The state hospital, I know this session is going to get, and rightfully so, a lot of attention. I've been saying that about every 124 years we seem to have a chance to build a new state hospital. important to recognize that we serve about 1,500 people a biennium in the state hospitals. So you can see that in mental health we serve well over 100,000 people total, and with about 25% of our total budget, we serve about 1,500 people in the state hospital. The state hospital is a very expensive service, and it's one that we've worked hard in Oregon to try to use in the most appropriate way and try to save our resources as much as possible for treating people in community settings. I know many of the members of this committee have heard this many, many times in the past number of years, but for those of you who haven't been following quite as much, I want to make sure that we point out the expensiveness of the state hospitals, and also point out from a budgetary standpoint that state hospitals primarily require state general fund services, whereas in the community we're much more able to leverage Medicaid services.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome back, and I hope things are well.
We are well. Thank you for asking. Madam Chair, I'm going to direct a question to Mr. Bob. Can I call you Bob?
Please.
Okay, directly, if I could. You and I have had that conversation before, and people kind of dance around this issue of how we deal with mental health in the state. And both as a physician and as a legislator, I've been very concerned about the entire system, not just the state hospital. And I'm very concerned that while we do obviously have a state hospital, the size of that state hospital is the real question. And whether or not the best policy is really a robust mental health system at a local level to prevent this overflow going in. And it's just building a state hospital is not going to solve the problem. We are seeing our local facilities close or degrade, which means more people go to the state hospital, some which shouldn't have to go there. And I'm wondering from a policy point of view and from a point of view of best treatment for those individuals, if community-based is not the best or the state hospital is best. My feeling is community-based is the best. Financially, it's a gain for us. It's a 60-40 match to the federal government. And I would direct those who have not seen the cost of a state hospital, not just building the building, but the cost of maintaining those beds is mind-boggling. And you need to look at that before we move forward with the state hospital as far as what size it is, where it's located, whether we need more than one. We need some real careful policy work here before we make a final decision. Would you comment? I mean, I'm starting the conversation now. We're going to have more conversations later, but it's an important issue.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I agree entirely that the proper functioning and size of the state hospital is entirely dependent on what we do in the community. We've been through rough years financially, obviously. All of you have been struggling with that. And what we've done is continue to invest in what we call the back end of community services so that we continue to create about 100 new community intensive beds or placements each year, but we've done almost no investment in what we now call the front end services, which are there to try to catch people in various stages before they either get to the acute care hospitals or the emergency rooms, which is where too many people are ending up, or the jails. We need to find better ways to divert people from emergency rooms, from jails. We need to find better ways to integrate with primary care, because many of the symptoms begin to show up there, and those are major initiatives that we need to be about and will be about, given the chance to do that. I think our crisis systems are straining. We need more programs like the early assessment supports teams that have developed in the Mid-Valley area. The governor's recommended budget would allow us to expand those considerably, and in my opinion, we will not be able to get ahead of this game until we really do the investment in the front-end services. So I know we'll have many more conversations, but that would be my general reaction to your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marcet.
Thank you. As long as you're on the subject of the front end, and your partners, which you're going to cover in just a minute, the county mental health programs and the treatment programs and nonprofits and so on, even though the governor has proposed more money, the counties are going to be losing money because of the forced timber receipts, and so there will be a continued crisis in this whole area, and there are some tentative solutions, proposed solutions to raise money from other sources, but you just said what I think I've been, you know, we've been talking about, is that the huge, huge cost shift from the front end to the back end, and how do we keep people out of the institutions, including the MIM hospitals, the jails, the prisons, the emergency rooms, and so on. So you're going to be getting into that, and I hope you talk a little bit about your partners who are helping on, you know, the extension of your programs.
Madam Chair, Senator Morrison, you're right. What the state does is really minor in comparison to what our community partners do, and whether that's county mental health programs or, you know, the private nonprofit providers. And I want to make sure that everybody understands that our community hospitals play a key role here. I mentioned emergency rooms, but about 15 years ago, the state shifted policies, and I think it was the right thing to do, is to no longer do the acute psychiatric inpatient care, in other words, the short treatments that take people from an immediate crisis and stabilize them. That's now being done in your community hospitals around the state. So Sacred Heart Hospital, of course, in Eugene and Senator Morissette's district, and Rogue Valley and Senator Bates, and I could go on. They are really the front line for the inpatient psychiatric services that are provided. They are all under a great deal of financial stress. These are not great money makers. You can make more money, I understand, from oncology units and other things that are much more high tech. But those are probably struggling too. I'm reading Senator Bates' signals properly. Acute care hospitals are under stress, and we hear from time to time that some of them are so stressed that they are thinking about closing. We're going to be continuing to meet with them. On the positive side, I understand in the Portland area now there are some programs like Kaiser and another organization that want to come in and expand acute inpatient care. So it really depends a little bit about where we're at in the state. But the whole point here is that we have to find ways to keep those programs healthy or everything else falls apart too. So we will indeed be talking, I hope, a lot more about the kind of front-end investments that we need to make.
Bob, the committee, I hope you don't mind if I make a comment. Each of our people presenting today have 20 minutes to make their presentation, and it's designed just to give us the big picture of this, and we can ask more copious, minute questions when they come back to us later on. So if you don't mind, from time to time, you'll hear me trying to push this on, if you don't mind. Thank you. Does somebody else have a hand up? Senator Wardley.
Thank you very much. Mr. Nickel, when you do come back, if you could share with us, I know that you're currently managing a health crisis at the state hospital with the outbreak of the norovirus. If you could come back to us and just tell us what the learnings are from managing that type of health crisis, given that we know we have a shortage of mental health workers and other workers in our overall delivery system. So what can we learn from this?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon will be happy to bring back a report on this.
Okay. Great. Would you also let us know how you're working with Rogue Valley, the hospital, and with their potential closure in July, too? If you're going to be able to talk about that.
I'm sure I will be. I don't know if I'll be happy to talk about that, but I will talk with you about that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Our handouts outline our delivery system. Again, I think I've already mentioned that historically we've contracted as a state through county mental health programs. Statutorily, they're designated as a local mental health authority. It allows for public accountability through elected officials. Counties are more and more contracting for the actual direct service through private nonprofit organizations, and I think about 12 or 14 county mental health systems already primarily, if not exclusively, contracted from the county to a private nonprofit organization. So I think that's been the trend, that more and more of the direct service is done at that level. But our contractual partners for planning and helping ensure accountability has traditionally been the county Board of Commissioners. This is true for alcohol and drug services as well as mental health services. I think I'll skip through. Oregon State Hospital is primarily a forensically oriented state hospital now. About two-thirds of the patients are there because they've run into a criminal justice issue. The others are there because they're civilly committed. And during the last biennium, we got out of the business entirely of treating kids, adolescents, and children in our state hospital. Contracted that out. Those programs are going very well, in my opinion. And I know the governor has felt that as a policy, we need not bring kids back into our state hospitals. It's simply not an appropriate place to let kids grow up. I'll say just briefly some things about outcomes. There's a national movement, of course, to do the same thing that we've been talking about in Oregon, which is to develop national outcome measures. And I'll try not to use acronyms. I think we gave it to you there, NOMS. This is a collaborative effort between the states and the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. I personally think that's coming along very well. I think the outcomes that are emerging from that are the very kind of things that we have been interested in providing better information to all of you about. Practical things like employment and improvement in kids' ability to stay in school, and reduction in crime, criminal involvement, and all those kind of things. So we can walk through in more detail on those as we go along. The major changes during 2005 for us at the federal level is for a considerable amount of anxiety about where things are going federally speaking. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has hired quite a few auditors nationally. We know that they're looking to see if there's anything that any of the states might be doing that's inappropriate. I think we are in support of that because Oregon has always tried to play it very much by the book in terms of our Medicaid programs. But the things that concern us probably more than that are concerns about whether things like case management, the rehabilitation option, our federal block grants are in jeopardy. And those are, I'm not saying that we know where that's going, but it's made us nervous and careful to think about how much further to expand Medicaid programs from where we are. Oregon has done quite a bit in that area, and I'm not sure that there's a lot more to be gained by trying to expand in Medicaid, although we're always open to looking at those possibilities. But I just want you to be aware that we're looking at that carefully so that we don't get reliant on something that might not be there later. I think I've mentioned already that Oregon's mental health system has been in existence a long time, actually 160 years. Some of the first arrangements at the organization of the territorial government involved five mentally ill people that folks didn't know what to do with. Given the shortness of time, I'll let you go ahead and read through the rest of the history section. I want to just mention that our key performance measures are only three in number. In my opinion, they don't cover everything that we do by any means, but for the record, number 18 is the percentage of clients who complete treatment for alcohol and drug abuse, and in 2005 we reported that 73% completed treatment. That percentage has remained consistent, but what has gone down in this state is the number of people who have been able to access treatment because of the loss of the Oregon Health Plan standard benefit for so many people and also other state general fund cuts in outpatient and residential care. Number 19 is the percentage of eighth graders at risk for alcohol and drug use, and I mentioned in my introductory remarks that 39% of eighth graders used alcohol or other drugs within the last 30 days, and it's been increasing, and I think that's something that we're paying a great deal of attention to. I won't go into detail now about some of the focus things that we're doing, but I will give you one example. We contracted with some federal enforcing underage drinking law money with an organization called Girls Incorporated, recognizing that we need to really focus in on what's happening with our girls. When they're drinking more than eighth grade boys, we really need to pay attention.
Well, I read that, and I want you to report on that one. You'll get for us. I read a report from the federal government in terms of the numbers of young women that are getting engaged in gang activity, and since the National Institute of Health has issued rule that that is as much of a mental health problem as it is in many instances when they get awry of the law, a criminal problem. So if you could talk about strategies that you guys are going to be using, if you're not already using some, to talk to us about that a little bit.
Madam Chair, we'll do that. Finally, the third high-level measure is the percentage of clients who maintain or improve functioning over the course of a mental health treatment episode. That and we showed in 2005 that 89% maintained or improved their functioning. We're never completely satisfied with the tools that we have to measure. We don't have the most current databases and the most sophisticated tools at our disposal, so we're looking at some ways that we can do a better job of that. And also, that's another one of the kinds of indicators that's in the national outcome measures. I'm just going to touch briefly on the outstanding issues. Substance abuse services for families and children going through the child welfare process. 62% of the families that are involved with child welfare have a methamphetamine issue going on. Many of those are also cover-ups for other emotional problems, and they also generate emotional problems for later on. We need to increase collaboration with courts and the criminal justice system and law enforcement. Many, if not most, of the counties actually are doing work with jails, but there's not enough resource for that, and we need to see what we can do to increase that that level of diversion and collaboration. We're embarking on an initiative that's going to be sponsored by the governor's office to do a better job of coordinating care and actually probably pooling or braiding funding for children who are the most severely disturbed, who often end up in juvenile justice and other settings and problems in school. We need to do a better job of integrating funding and services for those. We'll talk plenty about the state hospital as we go along. And Of course, I've already mentioned that another issue for us has been the loss of personnel and capacity as a result of the cuts that I don't think any of us were enjoying making over the last two biennia. But I think at this point we have a chance to rethink some of those policies and hopefully can get on top of more of that. I think with that, I will stop and not try to go in detail into the pie charts for finances, but if there are questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Questions of the committee? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. Just one, and it doesn't have to be today. It could be at another time if we're going to be getting specific information. Key performance measure number 18. I'm interested to understand why the percent has remained constant. On the one hand, it didn't get worse, but on the other hand, it's not getting better. So I'd like to understand what could help that be improved. Why are we not seeing improvement? That's enough for now. I don't want to take more time.
Quick question. Thank you very much, Mr. Nickel. How should we consider the children's mental health initiative passed during the last session, and work was done in the session before that as well? Where does that fit?
To Senator Gordley, I would be happy to provide more information on that. It certainly fits into the things that I mentioned. It was really a key forerunner to the larger children's system of care initiative that I mentioned that we're going to be embarking on. I think it gave us a lot of valuable lessons and some beginning experience about how you do that just within the mental health package of funding. And that's been challenging, but I think overall successful. Not that there haven't been glitches and still things to work out, but we're seeing kids spending less time in out-of-home, residential kind of care. We've seen day treatment programs get much more involved with schools directly on campuses. And I think there are a number of very positive things, but we can provide more of a detailed report on that.
Thank you.
And if I could say, Representative Nathanson, Madam Chair, we'll get some work done on the question you raised.
Thank you. Representative Kraus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Bob. As you're aware, in Klamath County, we had a lot of funding problems with alcohol and drug, et cetera, based on a formula for counties. Is that something we can take a look at?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, we'd be happy to talk some more about that. Included in the governor's recommended budget is money that would allow us to bring all of the counties up to the state per capita average without taking money away from any county. And so I think that's good news in terms of that equity issue that could have affected counties like Klamath, which were actually a little bit above the per capita average. And if we didn't have additional money in order to equalize things, we'd have to take money from somewhere.
Right.
So I think we have some potential solutions to that to talk with you about.
Look forward to it.
Further questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Allen, Public Health Director. There you are. Welcome.
For the record, I'm Susan Allen. I'm the State Public Health Director and the Assistant DHS Director for the Public Health Division. And thank you for the opportunity to give you an overview of our state's public health programs and our state's public health system. I will be able to hit only a few of the points in the short time that we're a rather small part of the Department of Human Services, as you'll see by budget, but we have a very large number and an extreme diversity of programs within the division. We have more than 100 programs and services, and I won't attempt to mention every one of them, but what will be of some help, I hope, is that at the end of your session, we've provided a sort of simple graphic organizational chart that should show how they hang together. I'd like to give you a sense of what kinds of things end up being identified as public health programs. And some of them may be a bit surprising to think of as health programs, and things such as drinking water regulation, for example, or the posting that we do for monitoring beaches for safety. Public health identifies the patient as the whole community. Our goal and the goal of our programs together is to create communities within which people have the best chance of being healthy. So it's somewhat less about direct service delivery, although some of the things we do, like giving immunizations to children, they look like service delivery, but we give the child that immunization for the benefit of the whole community, not just that child. Providing family planning services is for the benefit of the whole family, for greater success in school and ultimately productivity later in life. It's more than just about an individual person's service. So in general, what we're trying to do is create communities within which people have the best chance they could of being healthy, to keep and to minimize by prevention or early identification of problems the later need, the later disability, later health problems, later expensive medical care. In order to do this, there's a mix of service providers. The 34 local health departments are a key part of how services are provided, and as you'll see in the budget, about 61% of the funding that goes through us goes to local health departments. We also work through community coalitions around various kinds of preventive activities, such as tobacco prevention and certain kinds of safety. So they're actually community-based coalitions are a key part of many of our activities. We also have a large number of regulatory or monitoring activities, many of which we do directly with state staff, others of which are done at the local level in partnership. Our radiation program would be an example of one where the state is the direct service provider, or the regulation of medical and healthcare facilities, or of emergency medical technicians, for example. Those are things where the state staff do those programs. And in your budget area, where you see where it's referring to on page 12 of 12 in this section, I'm sorry, the vocabulary on this chart is a little confusing. It was inherited from previous biennia. And program support refers to what the state does directly. And then the program area, the 61%, is the funding that goes through to the local level. So our support for community local health departments is critical. And the other thing that you see that tells you a lot about our programs is on the chart on page 9 of 12. If you add up all of the federal bits, including the WIC bits, almost three-quarters of our budget is federal money. And only 10% of it, as you see, is general fund. And that creates some of the problems and constraints that we work within, because the federal money comes with guidelines, and it also comes with uncertain and varying funding streams. And that shows up in some of the challenges that we face in some of our programs. Let me just hit a few of our program areas and some of the key activities, performance measures, and challenges. A big part of our activity in the past few years has been around emergency preparedness. The main federal grants for hospital, medical system, or any kind of public health emergency preparedness come to us, and we're responsible for overseeing and coordinating them. All the funding in this program has been federal. It's been a significant amount of funding, but it changes every year, the guidelines and the funding amounts and the measuring processes have changed. But that is a very considerable amount, and that is merging more and more with our disease prevention and investigation activities. It was mentioned about norovirus during the previous presentation. We've had a significant increase in the number of outbreaks in the state last year. In 2005, 125 significant outbreaks were investigated across the diseases, in addition to many, many other diseases where the investigation happened early to prevent it. The local and state capacity for doing these kinds of investigations is stretched very thin. And what we're finding is that even just one ongoing norovirus outbreak in a nursing home or in a hospital or a daycare can be enough to overwhelm many of our smaller and mid-sized health departments for even weeks stretching their time. So we're looking at the question of our core capacity to protect people in their communities, because that's really what we're trying to do, is protect people in their communities. And we believe that the emergency preparedness and our environmental and disease investigation capacity are currently not adequate to ensure the level of what is needed in our communities. We also do vital records, birth and death records, and a big part of what public health provides for the rest of the Department of Human Services and for many other service providers is we're the primary collector of various kinds of data regarding health status, health systems, and so on. Environmental public health is a little odd in the Department of Human Services. These are the services that are the least connected to clients. So we inspect food facilities, where we provide support to local health departments regulating over 12,000 food facilities to make sure that the food delivered in restaurants is safe. A combination of environmental health and the epidemiology program investigated the spinach outbreak that Oregon was the first to identify was source of E. coli was spinach. And that's a combination of these programs together, the food and the disease investigation. We have drinking water system responsibility. I think it's pretty fundamental in a civilized society that people should be able to trust that the drinking water coming out of their tap is safe. We have in this state 115 of our drinking water systems where we cannot assure that at the moment. And we have over 900 very small systems that we don't at this point monitor and regulate at all. Our drinking water program is one of several environmental programs where we have highly dedicated and hardworking, knowledgeable staff who are not able to keep up with the timelines and the requirements that would be appropriate to ensure health. And recent assessments by the federal government found that our program was significantly out of compliance in some important ways. Unfortunately, that's also true of our radiation inspection program. Dedicated people who are trying to keep up with over 11,000 radiation sources, most of them in medical settings, medical imaging. They're getting more complex and there are more of them. A recent federal review of our program found staff knowledgeable and capable, but significantly behind. We currently have a backlog of over 700 inspections that we should be doing, and we're struggling to catch up with those. The work that we have done, when there's a significant hazard, of course, that becomes a priority, and we respond. We post for beach hazards so that people can be sure when they go to the beach they're not bathing in sewage. Office of Family Health provides a wide range of services to a large number of women and children on behalf of the communities, distributed over 650,000 doses of vaccine to private and public providers. But even with all of those efforts, only 65% of Oregon's two-year-olds are fully immunized the way they should be. We have a long way to go with that program. We have been able to meet 78% of the need for family planning, 156,000 men and women receiving those services, but that's still a significant level of need that's unmet. Nurses work with women who don't otherwise have access to prenatal care to get them into care. The Women, Infant, Children program provides nutritional counseling and food vouchers to pregnant women, nursing women, and children at nutritional risk. That program served 1 in 3 of Oregon's children under age 5. So the scope of these programs and the number of people that are encompassed within the Office of Family Health Programs is really considerable. We're not reaching everyone that needs these services. The Office of Multicultural Health serves as an important consultation and liaison service focus for us across our whole range of programs, particularly within the division, but also for the department, and has been working on increasing appropriate data collection to show health disparities, racial and ethnic health disparities, and also to work on a certifying medical interpreters program to make sure that that's done appropriately. The laboratory is a very fine lab, does high volume of 16.5 million tests, focusing especially on disease detection and newborn screening so that metabolic conditions that need early intervention can be found.
Thank you. May we go back a moment to the Office of Multicultural Health? And thank you. It appears, looking at the three outcomes listed on page 5 of 12, it appears that there are no key performance measures tied to these outcomes. Is that accurate, or are there key performance measures that just don't appear in the document that we have?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the program is being monitored by the progress we're making in the medical interpreter program, so there are some targets by the end of the current fiscal year for that. With respect to numbers of trainings and events that they've been providing consultation around, those are the primary measures that we're working with them on. If there were others to be suggested or of interest.
What I would like to see, Madam Chair, follow up is key performance measures developed and defined around the three outcomes that you have listed on page 5. Because if you look to page 7, where the performance measures and progress are listed, there's nothing that ties these measures back to the outcomes that you show for the Office of Multicultural Health. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I do. The challenge that we're having is that this program serves in a consultation mode, and its success sometimes shows up in the success of other programs.
Let me give you an example. If one of the outcomes is increased awareness around health disparities and how they can be eliminated, then a key performance measure might be framed around how are we doing and how do we know.
We will work on this and come back with some proposals.
Thank you.
Good questions? Thank you, Doc.
Thank you. With respect...
Excuse me, just a minute. Senator Morissette.
Well, I had another performance measure, but you're not there yet.
I was trying to incorporate them as I went through the programs.
Let me ask you the question very quickly. Hepatitis C is not listed as HIV.
Which one?
Is a serious test for hepatitis C.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we have a very active hepatitis C program, and I would be glad to provide you more details. Condense more than 100 programs into these, I'm afraid I'm leaving out a great deal, but hepatitis C, I will be glad to ensure that you get that information as well. And then the last sort of major program area is around access to care and community health and health planning, where we have supported the community-based development of another 21 community health centers and the placement of 120 physicians in communities with health care shortages and needs. We also license and oversee 8,000 emergency medical technicians. Our EMS trauma system is another area of, I'm afraid, deficiency, which we're proposing significant additional attention and development on. The state system is not currently providing adequate training, professional oversight, and assistance, and also statewide kind of intercommunity planning across the state to support the difficult and challenging service provision at the local level. We had a national assessment of this and subsequent state assessments and have targeted, have identified some key areas for improvement in that program. And then also we do certificate of need, hospital inspections, and we have the medical marijuana program. I would
one question, Doctor. At the close of this, I don't think I gave you a chance to finish that, but I'll ask at the close of your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to segue in the performance measures. I tried to integrate some of them as I went through the areas. And if there are others that anyone would like to ask more about a comment on, I'd be glad to. I did want to come back to the outstanding issues. Emergency preparedness and general capacity. Emergency preparedness isn't just for when the big one hits us or pandemic, but we really are seeing that it wouldn't take a very large chemical accident. It wouldn't take a very major train derailment with multiple people traumatized or even just the noroviruses or a much, much larger infectious disease outbreak of whooping cough than some of the ones we've had to really challenge the ability to control diseases and take care of people in our communities. We think if we can take care of the small and medium-sized outbreaks and disasters more effectively, we will be far better prepared to take care of the big ones. And this will continue to be an area of challenge and focus for us. Safe drinking water, I mentioned the concerns and the need for us to increase our resources, our staffing, to make sure that all Oregon have access to reliably safe drinking water, and the same with the radiation services. An area that we're worrying about but just stepping into is that the next wave of health challenges for all of us are chronic diseases, and many of those can be addressed through early intervention, and community-based interventions are typically more effective than medical interventions for chronic diseases such as arthritis and asthma and even diabetes. They need the partnership of those, not medical care alone, but a whole wraparound community approach to the prevention and support for those. And we think that will be the next challenge for us to be looking at in our public health programs. Beth.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then Senator Cordray.
I'm sure we're going to have some long discussions later on, and with the changing face of health care we're seeing today, the incredible cost of health care, the question really arises, what's the best way to deliver the health care? And you've touched on it here in your last few moments. Clearly, there are programs in this health department that are run very well. I'm thinking of the screening program for newborns as a good example. I think you've even picked up a new state now. I think they did New Mexico just join us in? Mm-hmm. Remember right?
That is correct.
I mean, it's the program is not only an outstanding one, but one other states send their labs or their blood tests to us to do. I mean, that's how good it is. But I'm questioning in my mind what the role of public health is as far as health care is concerned now. And I'm going to tell you that we're going to be discussing it with you as we see health reform come forward. There's more that needs to be done in some areas, inoculations, and I question whether or not individual treatment of individual patients is appropriate in the settings we have now and the reform we're trying to see in health care. The interface of these two areas is going to be very important. We're going to bring health care costs under control and get better outcomes. We've got a long ways to go.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that there are many benefits for the communities for better prevention and detection and actually more humane and effective service delivery systems. I look forward to that discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Allen, the Chair, Carter, Representative Boone, and I all served on the interim Joint Emergency Preparedness Committee, as I know you recall. And when I look at this area of public health emergency preparedness, again, I go back to key performance measures, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about how should we look at that? And I, in the absence of a key performance measure, at least on the list that we have in front of us, how should we be looking at issues around how prepared are we and how do we know, given emergency scenario, you know, how do we look at community capacity, ability to respond, again, in a given emergency? Your thoughts, please, about a key performance measure.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, that's literally a $6 billion question you just asked, and I wish there were better answers than what I'm going to give you. As I think you're well aware from the hearings with the Joint Emergency Preparedness Committee, as you mentioned, there's not all of the funding that we have for emergency preparedness activities is federal. The federal grants have extensive reporting requirements, 30 to 60 page reports, often with very detailed counting of widgets, activities, trainings, and so on. And they have changed sometimes every year and sometimes every 6 months. So it has hindered us. This is really at this point not generally for better, essentially driven by the federal outcomes and expectations. And the federal government, for all of the research and money they put into this, have not been able to define for either states or communities what are appropriate measures. We've had extensive discussions, and the truth be told, we rarely get past the struggle to submit the repeated grants and to submit the repetitive reports that the federal government has asked of us. That's not a very satisfactory answer, but it's the truth.
Question. And I just want to thank you for your
2 minutes.
I can do it quicker than that. Thank you for your comments, and just wanted to reiterate my concerns. And just as a volunteer EMT, now lapsed into a volunteer flare setter on scenes anymore, but the increasing requirements and regulations on volunteer fire departments, which are handling a lot of medical emergencies now. I'm concerned about adding so much more on top of their list of time that they must spend away from their jobs and their families that they'll just quit, and then we won't have them, even at my capacity of being the master flare setter for Clatsop County. But I do understand the need for it, and I understand what you need, what you're up against too, and especially from what you just said about your federal money coming in and the reports that you have to give. So if you can't provide the services, if you give money to counties to give to their or districts or whatever, and they can't give you the performance outcomes that you need to qualify the receipt of that money, you'll lose your grant, or you'll have to return it, or what, who knows what. But my concerns are that most of these rural areas just do operate with the volunteer departments, and that's a huge issue.
Dr. I'd like your response to be limited to 1 minute. We have two other people to, and now we've cut your time down to 15 minutes to the other two people that are coming.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Boone, we shared the exact concern, and on another occasion I'd be glad to provide you more detail of our EMS trauma proposal, but our goal is to take the services to the communities to make sure that we maximize the training and minimize the difficulty for them, because everybody in the state deserves good EMS services. We don't want to have a two-tier system where rural areas are more vulnerable. We want to bring the capacity to them, and that's what most of our EMS proposal is about.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Allen, very much. Mr. Tays? You have to fault the committee for cutting your minutes down to 15. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services Senior Disability Program. And I'll move through very quickly. In the written material, I think what I'll try to focus in is a couple of the graphs that really sort of tell the story about senior disability services, and also draw your attention pretty quickly to the major issues that are looming in the senior disability program, which really is the aging demographic and how that's going to sort of explode in the next 20 years and really affect how we provide and pay for services. If you look on page 2 of the handout, the two different graphs. One reflects the array of services for seniors and people with physical disabilities, and the one on the bottom, those with developmental disabilities. And you see a fairly similar trend across all these populations, which is historic in Oregon. Beginning in 1981, the Oregon legislature adopted a fairly aggressive policy that Oregon would serve all of our vulnerable populations at home in community-based settings, that we would lessen the impact of institutional care and use it only selectively for people with real critical needs. And Oregon has done that very successfully over a 25-year period of time. And you see the explosion in the in-home program across both of these areas, with the exception that in the senior and physical disability area, there was a big downturn during the 2003-2005 biennium as a result of some of the budget reductions that happened during that time. Oregon, at this point in time, still leads the rest of the country in the percentage of people that we serve in community-based settings or their own homes, and as well as the expenditures for long-term care that are primarily based on the community side. There's only actually five states that expend more than 50% of their long-term care resources on the community side, with Oregon leading the pack at about 70%, Vermont, New Mexico, Alaska, and Washington are the other five. And then when you go down through most of the other states, you see almost the opposite trend, where the vast expenditures are still in institutional services. In most states now, looking at the aging demographic, are really trying to look at what Oregon did 25 years ago. They're trying to reposition their states to serve people in less expensive and more community-based settings. So these really are the service patterns. In addition, the Senior and Disability Program provides a variety of financial assistance programs. Our offices do all of the eligibility for the health plan and for food stamps, and we really have sort of an integrated full service center for the Senior and Disability Program, where people can get the help they need in one place. The service delivery system, similar to mental health and public health, is primarily based on our relationship with local government. On the senior side, we contract most of our services in terms of eligibility, case management, protective services, and all of that through area agencies on aging. That's a unique relationship compared to most states, where the AAAs only do Older American Act programs. In Oregon, they also do the full expanse of Medicaid and OHP and food stamp eligibility as well. And then in the more rural areas of the state, eastern Oregon, along the coast, the AAAs do only the Older American Act programs, and then we have state field offices that back them up to do the Medicaid portion of the program. Our field has performed, I think, heroically in recent years. Actually, many of our staffing ratios are almost 20 years old, and yet the workload has just really, really increased dramatically in recent years. Things like the Medicare Modernization Act and other things that have just heaped additional requirements and workload on a field that really has struggled to keep pace with that. And then in addition to our field structure, we contract with literally hundreds and hundreds of providers, nursing homes, assisted living, group homes, in-home programs. It's a very expansive system of decentralized services across the state. The history, I pretty much mentioned that the early 80s really was where the legislature set the policy direction. I think Oregon did a couple remarkable things early on that are sort of fraying at the edges now, but early on, in addition to an aggressive policy for community-based care, we adopted a very aggressive Nurse Delegation Act, probably the most aggressive in the country, that allows us to delegate and actually allow tasks to be done by lay people in a person's home under the supervision of a nurse and authorized by the doctor, which many states do not allow. I think in Oregon, rightfully so many years ago, really tried to craft a partnership between private pay programs and the Medicaid program. And as you looked at the expansion of assisted living and residential care and others, it really has been a good fit, because in as much as you have a rich private pay market where people, when they need long-term care, have that sort of catastrophic event in the hospital and need to go into long-term care, if they have good private pay options that are less expensive, they don't spend down as quickly compared to other states where they would just go directly into a nursing home. So I think that rich mix of services has been good. But it's clearly fraying as the Medicaid rates haven't kept up with real costs, and the disparity between private pay and Medicaid costs is really beginning to become a crisis in parts of our system. If I could direct you to the chart on page 7 and really highlight what we're struggling with and thinking about right now.
We were just struggling with that because that's it. This is scary.
Madam Chair, when I say that AARP reminds me that this is an opportunity, and so I'm a little bit cautious in saying it's scary. But it is. It has dramatic impacts on how we think about service delivery and how we pay for those services. The governor charged us in the last budget cycle to develop a long-range plan. We've been working with a large stakeholder group, many subgroups. We've had public forums all over the state in the last year, and we're still at a fairly high conceptual level on where we need to go with the dramatic aging demographic. The numbers tell it all. People of retirement age and above will double in the next 20 years. The subgroup of people 85 plus will grow pretty dramatically, which obviously sort of is almost geometric then in the number of people that require long-term care supports. We've also taken these numbers and we've trended them across the Medicaid population, because typically when you look at all the senior and disability population, on the senior side, typically 75% of all seniors get along pretty well on their own. About 20% then need several assistance with daily living skills that typically are provided by the spouse or by the family member, and really it's kind of a 5% that really require expensive long-term care and Medicaid supports. So we're taking all those sort of traditional studies of how the population breaks down in service needs, trending it across these population lines. We expect, based on that trend analysis, just our Medicaid population between now and 2025 will nearly double, from about 30,000 on the senior and physical disability side to about 50,000. We've actually drill down in each of your communities. We are taking census data and other trend analysis and trying to say this is what we think the demographics will be in your specific community. This is how many providers you have of different types now. This is what the gap would be in terms of workers you would need and additional programs and facilities in the next 20 years to accommodate this kind of need. And again, it's pretty dramatic, and it begs the question not only how do we pay for that, but where would we get the workers to actually supply that huge labor pool. For that reason, we're really thinking about the long-range plan in two respects. One is, how can we bring every strategy possible to bear on keeping people healthy and safe and independent for as long as possible, and getting communities ready to prevent whenever possible that time when a person actually needs paid long-term care assistance. And those activities basically fall out on how do we begin to market an affordable, good long-term care insurance product. We're doing a lot of work with DCBS on that right now. Congress has passed a new act that really will provide some very strong incentives for long-term care insurance. So that certainly will be a major component to do financial planning, because most people don't think they'll need it, don't buy it, and even states like Oregon that have tax incentives to buy long-term care insurance, the tax incentives by themselves don't seem to change the penetration very much, because people think Medicaid or Medicare or somebody will pay for it. So we have a huge marketing campaign to go forward there. We recently received a set of major grants in which we will pilot in 4 counties healthy aging strategies around diet and exercise, which even in latter years can have a very dramatic impact on a person's skill levels and ability to maintain their daily living skills. So that will be part of it. And then really looking, as we've gone from community to community, and we've looked at the senior companion programs, parish nursing programs, there's a lot of very good things that go on, but we think that we need a much more connected strategy where, as a community as a whole, you sort of have that whole array of supports in place, and we begin to look at our mission much more as reaching out to the public and to individuals and communities. Then, stepping back, though, obviously there will still be lots of people that need paid long-term care. And on the Medicaid side, the There's a lot of activity going on at the federal level. Congress, when they passed the Deficit Reduction Act, has now given states some dramatic new opportunities to reconfigure their long-term care systems. And the most dramatic part is states like Oregon, where we fund all of our community services with home and community-based waivers, they're always tied to an institutional level of need. And so we've deliberately taken a broad definition of institutional care so you could get people eligible on the community side. Congress has passed several new state plan options where you can disconnect that institutional eligibility and really redefine the benefit level that is needed on the community side and tailor it just to that. And I think that has some potential results in being able to realign really what people's income, their exact acuity need is, and what exact level of care that we can support and provide a more logical continuum of services. So we're looking at that as a couple options, and we've applied for a grant called Money Follows the Person, which the federal government will actually give us a higher match rate from the traditional 60% federal match to 80% if we relocate even additional persons out of institutions who have lived there for 6 months or more, and we're exploring that. So there's a lot of activity going on here. How that all fits together yet is a bit uncertain. Some of the new federal initiatives, the federal regulations are not even out yet, so we're uncertain yet whether or not they will really fit in Oregon's long-range plan. And some of these options may not become real clear even until after you've gone home. So I think during our full Ways and Means presentation, we'll want to delve more deeply into some of these different options so that if Oregon can avail itself of some of these options later in the biennium, that you certainly are aware of those policy directions and that we certainly would look at doing that within the budget authority that we leave here that you've established for us. We're also looking at some other controversial things like combinations of acute care and long-term care. Obviously, as the population ages, for those over age 85 who become more medically fragile, their long-term care needs will all often be precipitated by changes in their medical care. There's a lot of nervousness about how we might do that, and we're continuing to have a lot of discussions about that as well. So a lot of things are in the mix. A couple other major items that are pending are developmental disability service system, and I'm sure you'll hear a lot about that, has some serious stresses and strains. Our providers are struggling to recruit and retain qualified workers. They often have very high vacancy rates, very high turnover rates, and as you serve an increasingly fragile population.
Madam Chair.
You're
touching on an area that I was going to ask a question about. The state settlement lawsuit in 2000 agreed to phase in community services and so on. I met with that population. I'm going to be meeting with them again. Where are we on full implementation of the state settlement?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, during the 2003-2005 biennium, we actually renegotiated the terms of the settlement, stretched it out to 2011. By the end of this next biennium, we have to be fully ramped up for all eligible people, and after that, then going into the 2009-2011 biennium, anybody who's eligible, we have to serve within 90 days. So we're 2 years away from having to be fully ramped up, and at that point in time can no longer have waiting lists. We will have to phase in about 1,000 plus more people in the next biennium. It's built into the governor's recommended budget, and then we should be at the end of waiting lists. But that's only on the in-home side. We still obviously have long waiting lists for residential care, but part of the Staley agreement was an agreement to try to serve everybody with at least some supports for those who live with their families or on their own, while keeping a fairly tight cap on the 24-hour side so we could simply pay for the big expansion. But to your question, it'll be within 2 years that we're fully phased in.
I'll check with you in 2 years.
So, Mr. Chair, have we accessed all the matching dollars that are possible to us in terms of the long-term care possibilities are? Even the 1,000 people that you said that you're going to have to bring in the next 2 years, are there matching funds available for that?
Madam Chair, we match everything that moves, and
something that don't
within the limits of the law.
Well, yes, and actually, the federal auditors have been out here looking at, because I think Oregon, we took a very expansive view of Medicaid, and I think rightfully so. We said we want to stretch this program as far as it can go, and perhaps a little bit beyond on the community side, and we've had to pull back. We, for example, with our local partners, used to do a lot of local match, where they can, you know, take local revenue and we would match it and allow us to even expand beyond our typical Medicaid programs. And we did some wonderful things with that. We've had to pull back that. So we're having to retrench as federal auditors come and really take a much tighter view of this. But on the other hand, we are still looking at, for example, Money Follows the Person, a new federal initiative, gives you a higher federal match. So we'll certainly explore that. For everybody being phased in the Staley agreement, that will all be fully matched. So really, it's in our budget, it's a very small percentage that is general fund only, because most of the general fund is even involved in the local match for the federal program.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
We have one more reporter, and we're down 2 minutes on his time. Okay, push it.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Pakshresh?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Firbors Baksuresh, DHS Chief Administrative Officer. I am aware of the time limitations, so I'll be brief. The Administrative Services Division of the Department of Human Services is the support arm of the organization, basically providing services to other divisions to directly serve our clients. The only reason for our existence is because of the other divisions and the clients. We often remind ourselves of that and the people who work for us, and we're often reminded by our colleagues. And frankly, everything that we do can be provided by someone else, whether within the department or outside. And for that reason and purpose, we have to be consciously aware, continuously, of the value of the services that we are providing. Yesterday, our director, Dr. Goldberg, provided a high-level overview of the director's office, so I'm not going to cover those in my presentation. Page 1 and 2 in your packet list the offices within the director's office: Office of Audit and Consulting Services, Office of Public Policy and Government Relations, Governor's Advocacy Office, and Office of Investigations and Training. We'll provide more in-depth overview of that when we come back. Jim Scherzinger, our deputy director of finance, provided a brief overview of the finance piece of the organization, and the two offices that are part of that operation: Office of Finance and Policy Analysis and Office of Financial Services. So what I'm going to do is go to page 5 and briefly cover the 8 offices that exist within the Administrative Services section of the division. Before I do that, I just wanted to take a moment and acknowledge a small team of professionals who are responsible for managing policies and other items such as performance measurement, process improvement, project management, and leadership development. This is a small group, but highly productive and very essential to the strategic direction of Administrative Services. So I just wanted to acknowledge that team, because oftentimes they don't get recognized because they're not part of a particular office. So let's begin with the Office of Facilities, which provides coordination of the department's facilities statewide, supporting the department's move toward greater integration of services. Facilities manages over 2 million square feet of space statewide in 165 offices, with a vacancy rate of less than 0.5%. Our Office of Contracts and Procurement manages over 8,600 contracts per biennium, with a combined value of $6.4 billion. The office makes purchases and processes contracts with other governmental agencies, businesses, and service providers. Office of Communications informs our employees, partners, policymakers, the media, the general public, and other audiences about the department, its programs, and its mission and overall direction. The office receives and handles approximately 200 inquiries per month from news organizations. This office also manages the VHS website and publications.
Let me just ask one question.
Sure.
I see on here it's just overwhelming. 8,600 contracts. Is there a compliance officer that is in charge of all those different contracts, or how do you handle that?
We actually have, that is why DHS has its own Office of Contracts and Procurement. Otherwise, you know, most other state agency, Madam Chair, handle the contracting through Department of Administrative Services, the Central Procurement Unit. But because of the size of the agency, and as you already know, over 80% of our budget goes to local providers, and all of these are handled through contracts. We have an administrator who manages that office and a group of about 30 people who administer and manage those contracts.
Thank you.
Sure. Office of Human Resources serves all DHS employees in the locations that we have statewide. You may know that nearly 24% of our workforce is assigned to 24-hour-a-day institutions, such as the Oregon State Hospital. Office of Human Resources also provides services such as labor relations, performance management, and recruitment. The office also provides criminal background screening of employees, volunteers, and providers every month. We do over 19,000 criminal record checks. A small portion of that are for employees, only about 3%. The rest of those are for service providers. Our Office of Document Management provides a range of services that manages both physical and electronic management of documents. It also handles forms development and distribution, and also language translation, alternate formats, including Braille. Every month, one of the other functions that this office provides is it processes Medicaid provider claims. They scan those documents, almost 109,000 claims each month from dentists, doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, and other Medicaid providers. They electronically image more than 500,000 pages of documents each month. Again, the intent there is to minimize handling the paper and transportation of files. Office of Information Services provides information technology solutions and manages more than 350 applications that support all VHS programs. And also we serve many of the partner organizations that we do business with. The office is engaged in major system modernization efforts such as the Medicaid Management Information System, MMIS, or the State Automated Child Welfare Information System, SACWIS. It works closely with the newly developed state data center on network and computing operations. Office of Information Security is responsible for meeting the department's information security and privacy needs, and as you all know, those two topics have been gaining more and more importance within the past few years. The office also is in charge of coordinating business continuity management activities within the department. During this biennium, the office received 128 privacy concerns and 122 security issues that it had to deal with. Through coordination of activities, the office has managed to reduce by 80% the number of misdirected email containing sensitive information. And last but not least is the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. This office was established in 2005, and it is a collection of 11 previously separate DHS units that were brought together under a common organizational umbrella. OPAR's mission is to ensure program integrity by improving payment accuracy and recovery. The program, working closely with other DHS divisions, recouped more than $58 million in overpayments in 2005. So that's just a quick overview of the programs. Madam Chair, you had asked something, a question yesterday about the representation of minorities in the department.
That's right.
And I just have some, we will provide you with some written documentation, but I just wanted to share a few statistics with you. And this is basically from the 2000 U.S. Census data. As you know, the census is taken every 10 years. So it's a few years old, and some of these statistics have changed, but not significantly. In Oregon, basically, this is the breakdown of the population. They have 86.6% white, 8% Hispanic and Latinos, 3.7% Asian and Pacific Islanders, and 2.5% Indian and Alaskan Native, and 2.1% Black or African American. And I want to give you the statistics for DHS. And that's about 82.7% white, 8.1% Hispanic and Latino, 4.3% Asian and Pacific Islander, 2% Indian and Alaskan Native, and 2.7% Black or African American. So in that front, we're tracking pretty well and are ahead of some of the numbers, you know, when you look across the state. Overall, in DHS, we have 17.28% ethnic representation. And I just wanted to share with you some data from Department of Employment. This is from 2004 that indicates that blacks and African Americans make up 1.5% of the Oregon workforce, and 64% of Oregon's black working age population resides in Multnomah County. And then American Indians, 1.1%, Asian Pacific Islanders, 3.6%, and Hispanics, 8.6%. One thing that I wanted to mention, you also were interested in higher salary range. You know, how are folks doing in that? And I want to quote directly from our director, Dr. Goldberg's weekly message just 2 weeks ago, actually just last week, January 19th, that's correct. Within DHS, salary range 24 and above, women make up 67.8% of the employees compared to 44.5% statewide compared to other state public organizations. Our persons of color are 12.6% compared to 9.7% compared to other state agencies. And our disabled population is 3.7% versus 2.7% for other state agencies. And one thing that I wanted to share with you is that it's pretty easy to be self-congratulating and saying that we're doing well, but as our director has clearly communicated to us, our goal is to become closer and closer to the population that we serve. And when we look at that data, we have some work to do, because as we look at our population that we're serving, we are seeing that 75% of those are white, 15% are Hispanic, 5% are black or African American, 3% Asian or Pacific Islander, and 3% Indian and Alaskan Native. So I just wanted you to know that we are aware of these things, we are looking at these, and we'll provide you know, the data that you requested. I think we're doing well, we're doing better than we were doing a couple of years back, but we have some work to do in that area.
Questions? Representative Matheson.
Thank you. My question is with regard to the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. It's good to know that the office is actively working to recoup money. You mentioned that $58 million has been recouped in overpayments or other amounts due. Is that all of the money that would have been due? In other words, is that about all there is to get? Or is that just the tip of the iceberg if you were to able to audit or review other accounts?
Madam Chair, Representative Nicholson, it is the tip of the iceberg. Certainly we only collect a small percentage of what is due. And, you know, this is a very delicate balance as we get into looking at recovering overpayments. Many of the folks that we're going after to recover payments are low-income part of the low-income population, and we have to make sure that we're not creating a situation that they're going to come back on the public assistance role. So we are very careful in that, but you know, in fact, our administrator of Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery is here, Tricia Baxter, and she's done a great job in creating that balance, but she'll tell you that if we had more overpayment recovery writers and agents, we could collect more. We also contract with some private contractors to collect some of the debt that we cannot collect, and they get a percentage of that collection, but at the end we end up ahead than behind.
Mm-hmm. I would be interested to understand more about that balance. I would like to be sure that we recover money where there's the ability to pay, and be very sensitive to the other kinds of situations.
Absolutely, and we can provide that information.
Thank you.
Further question, Dr. Bay?
Just a question. I understand that, and I might be wrong with this, but you're undergoing a pilot program with Mr. John Ramsey, bringing in efficiency measures that have been used in business world and trying to apply them to government work. And this is sort of a new thing,
right,
as far as that kind of an approach to government programs. I don't want to comment now, but I would ask that are you considering bringing to us the information that's been gained from that and where you are in the process sometime during these sessions?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, absolutely. Page 8 of the presentation, the last paragraph, talks about the operations review team that I think Jim Scherzinger talked about yesterday. On page 9, under outstanding issues, there was a reference precisely to what you were talking about. And, you know, I just want to take a moment and acknowledge the sense of gratitude that we have as a department, and I personally, to John Ramsey, for the services that he has provided. Basically, what you're referring to is this methodology called Lean, which emerged out of the Toyota production system, and it is intended to squeeze waste out of every organization and make every administrative or operational process as lean. It is something that is not totally new to us. We've been doing some of that, but not at this scale. And John Ramsey has done this over and over again, so he has provided valuable free consulting services to us. The RFP that we wrote, he was critical in doing that, and we will share information with you. The project, in fact, just started this week. The contractors on site, they started on Monday, and frankly, this was one of the quickest contracts that we put on the street and awarded. And again, credit goes to John.
For those who don't know, John Ramsey is former executive vice president of a little company whose budget was bigger than ours, Lockheed Martin. And he has huge experience. This is what he did for a living for the last 20 years. He was very successful at it. And so his expertise and the people he knows and brought into this process is really kind of amazing. And John just does it because he'd like to see more effective government. Thank you.
No further questions?
No.
Anything else we're going to order? Thank you very much. Committee dismissed.